Well, hello, folks. That was the Danish National Anthem introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss issues of important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we're listening. We want to talk about Denmark today, as sung in the National Anthem there, a very peaceful song for a land that's often held up as a lovely country, a land of progressive values, a land that people like Bernie Sanders really like to recommend, because this country of Denmark in 2005 became a center of Muslim rage when the Jyllands-Posten, a Danish newspaper, published 12 cartoons, caricatures of Muhammad on September 30th, 2005, and that set off the so-called cartoon crisis. And just recently, on July 14th, this past month, one of the cartoonists, Kurt Vestergaard, who is known for having made perhaps the most noted of the cartoons in the series of a dozen cartoons, the cartoon of Muhammad with a bomb in his turban, died. So we want to reflect on the life of Kurt Vestergaard and the issue of free speech under jihadist assault since 2005. And to discuss those issues, we want to join with Deborah Weiss, a practicing attorney and free speech advocate who has worked with the Congressional Committee on House Oversight and is an author of numerous publications, including the Center for Security Policy Monograph, The Organization of Islamic Corporations, Jihad on Free Speech. What lesson, and we want to learn from her about this Well, here I am again. We're trying to get Deborah Weiss in. We're having some difficulty somehow to get her in. Never experienced this before with anyone calling in, but we want to bring her in and listen to her. This is a very interesting person, a friend and colleague here, Deborah Weiss, whom I have collaborated with before on issues involving free speech and jihadist. Here we go. Here we should have Deborah Weiss. Deborah Weiss is coming.
Hi.
Oh, Deborah Weiss, are you there? Can you hear me?
I'm here. I can hear
All
you.
Right,
can you
excellent.
Hear me?
Well, we got Deborah Weiss here, and
we're ready to start the show. I hope my battery doesn't die. I hope my battery doesn't die, because this is a different phone, and oh well.
It's good to have you here. Well, we've had some difficulties here. I introduced the show here. We start out with the Danish national anthem, singing of this lovely land and such a peaceful land, which became such a center of a crisis in 2005. Well, as I mentioned to our listeners, discuss for us this cartoon crisis set off by the Jyllands-Posten, a Danish newspaper, on September 30th, 2005. And what should we really... I'll learn from that.
What should we learn from the daily crisis, from the crisis?
Yeah, you've had contact. You actually met with Kurt Vestergaard, the cartoonist, once, as well as the editor, Fleming Rose, who oversaw the publication of the cartoons. Introduce us to our viewers. Talk about the cartoon crisis of 2005 and 2006, and what sort of important observations you have from that.
Yeah, I think we should start by talking about what actually happened. I'm guessing most of your audience knows, but just for those who don't, in about 2005, there was a Danish author, Per Bludigen, who wrote a children's book on Islam and wanted somebody to be the illustrator, and he couldn't find anyone to agree to do it because they were all afraid. He finally found somebody to do it anonymously. But subsequently, the Danish paper Jyllands-Posten asked for illustrators to draw a cartoon of Muhammad and submit it, and it's going to publish them. So 12 cartoons were published, and Kurt Vestergaard did one that became either famous or infamous, depending on your position, of the Muslim prophet Muhammad with an explosive in his turban. So subsequently, that newspaper was targeted for terrorist attacks. One of the editors, Fleming Rose, was targeted personally. They had to have heavy security at that publication ever since. Kurt Vestergaard, who was the illustrator of that particular cartoon, had numerous attacks on his life and wound up having to have a panic room in his home. He had to have 24-hour protection, and I guess the reason we're doing the show today is he just recently died on July 14th at the age of 86. So that's the long and the short of it. I mean, there have been numerous terrorist attacks since then for people who draw pictures of Muhammad or who blaspheme Allah, people who say anything that violates Islam's blasphemy code are often targeted with death threats.
Yeah, indeed. Kurt Vestergaard on New Year's Day 2010, as Fleming Rose, his former editor at Yellen's Post, and wrote in his 2013 book, I'm trying to remember the year, The Tyranny of Silence. He goes into detail of the whole cartoon crisis and talks about Kurt Vestergaard on New Year's Day 2010 experiencing an attack from a man of Somali background linked with Al-Shabaab, the terrorist group Al-Shabaab, who came into his home when Kurt Vestergaard was there with his 5-year-old granddaughter, and he had to flee into this panic room that was set up in his home under police protection and call for the police to come and barely survive this attack by this a man with an axe and a knife. So that was one incident, one attack on Kurt Vestergaard.
He wasn't actually attacked. So I don't know, barely attacked. I mean, he barely got away. He just barely got away,
and then the police came and he was captured. But, you know, one thing that Fleming Rose talked about in this book is that during this cartoon crisis, the United Nations as well as the European Union leaders, like the then European Union Foreign Representative Yanvir Solana, that actually really showed little interest in upholding free speech of Denmark during this crisis. Is that shocking?
I didn't hear what you said. They did what on the free speech in Denmark?
They weren't really interested in upholding the free speech rights of Denmark and of this Danish newspaper during this crisis, when all these Muslim organizations around the world were demanding, you know, like punishment for the newspaper. I mean, isn't that shocking?
I mean, not to me, because I've been working on this issue for years and years and years. But it might be shocking to a lot of Americans who wrongly assume that the rest of the world has freedom of speech the way we do here. And even in Europe, they do not. This is a unique country. There's no place on earth that has anything equivalent to the First Amendment. Europe has every country, or virtually every country in Europe, has some kind of hate speech law. And they tend to do a balancing test, I think. Fleming Rose did talk about this in his book, or at least he spoke about it in some presentation I heard of him years ago, where they do a balancing test of freedom versus offense. So the European hate speech laws, they vary from country to country. Sometimes they're incitement to hatred. So a lot of times they condemn what's called group hate, whether it's based on religion or ethnicity or race. But in America, this is really the only place where we are free to say whatever we want, so long, like, you can't defame somebody in our definition of the word, which means you can't make a false factual statement, a false statement that results in some kind of pecuniary or reputational harm in a public setting, you know? So if you're going to make a comment about a business person or a company, and you're going to put it in print, it better be true, otherwise they can sue you. And if you say something about them that's negative and it's true, then truth is a defense. But that's not the case in other countries. In other countries, it's irrelevant whether it's true or not, if it's offensive. When it's negative, it could be offensive. And so, you know, that's not allowed. And the other major difference is in America, you're entitled to voice your opinion, no matter how terrible or negative it is. And in other countries, if you voice your opinion and it sheds the other person or other group in a negative light, it could be a legal problem for you. But the UN, I'm saying the UN is definitely no surprise to me, because they are largely influenced by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, which is comprised of 56 UN member Muslim majority countries plus the Palestinian Authority, and those countries are all in favor of blasphemy laws. And whereas you have certain people in Europe, like members of parliament like Geert Wilders in Denmark, who are advocating for a worldwide or a European First Amendment, you have the Islamists in the form of the OIC and other organizations
who are advocating for worldwide Islamic blasphemy laws. So, no, I'm not surprised. They are not advocates for freedom of speech.
Yeah, and you mentioned these legal standards, you know, truth as a defense in the United States, in particular in the case of Denmark, which you and I have studied. You have the law there, this section 266B in the Danish legal code that punishes hate speech, and there precisely, as you indicate, truth is not a defense. So there have been people punished in Denmark for their speech about Islam, and it's irrelevant whether what they said about Islam or Muslims in general or any sort of Muslim practices is indeed true. It's just simply a question of, did you offend people? I mean, there have been people who have criticized issues of, like, child marriage or honor killings and such among Muslims, and they've been fined under this Danish hate speech law, Section 266B. Well, you know, you've met with Vestergaard and Fleming Rose before when they've come here to the United States for various events. Do you have any particular impressions from these encounters?
Did I have any particular what?
Any particular impressions from these encounters? Did they say anything in particular that stood out?
Kurt Vestergaard, I met years and years ago along with three other people who were here. I actually didn't realize that they had followed my work. I had never heard of them. They all worked for the Danish Free Press Society, which at that time, this is a lot of years ago, I hadn't heard of. And I'll tell you, when I first met them, there was an invitation-only gathering at the Capitol of Geert Wilders, which is, for those of you in the audience who don't know, he's a Danish member of parliament. He's head of the Freedom Party, which is the most popular party in Denmark. It doesn't operate the same way there as it does here. They have 11 political parties, but his is the largest and most popular. And he is very, for lack of a better term, anti-Islam, and has been under extreme scrutiny and under his own death threats for it for a number of years. Anyway, I'm a big free speech advocate, and even before we had the kind of woke censorship that we have today, we had the Islamist censorship from years ago that I was writing about extensively, and there were several people from the Danish Free Press Society that came all the way from Denmark to come in here to build this speak, and I met them at this event. Somebody said, "Hey, look who's here, Deborah Weiss," and I was like, "What?" I didn't even know anyone read my things, actually. But I met them, and a few of us went out to dinner. Kurt Vestergaard was one of them, and Lars Hedegaard was another one, who I wound up being on a panel with at the Heritage Foundation, which I think you wrote about at an event. But so I can't say that I don't know if I learned anything specific, except that it was a huge problem in Denmark, and that there were people who were trying to advocate for freedom of speech, that free speech was under tremendous pressure there. Part of why it was such a big issue in Denmark is they had huge influxes of Muslim immigrants. They were not refugees, they were immigrants into Denmark, and they were largely Sprako, and they were Muslim, and they came from different culture. They had different values. Freedom of speech was not one of them. So it was causing an increasing problem there, including when Geert Wilders stated his opinion as a politician of what the positions should be, what the policy positions should be in Denmark. He said he would be for limiting or restricting more immigrants from Morocco because it was causing all kinds of problems in the community because they were not assimilating. And for making that comment and for other comments he made, he was actually prosecuted, which, you know, criminally prosecuted under that same section of the Danish Penal Code that you mentioned earlier, Andrew. And it was quite strange because due to his popularity, a lot of people at the time were talking about the possibility that he might wind up being the next prime minister of Denmark. And there he was, also facing the potential of jail time for simply making speech that some Muslims found offensive. So he had this, was in this strange position for about a year, because that trial dragged on for a year, where he potentially could have been prime minister and in jail all at the same time. Fortunately, he was acquitted, but he has, as you know, his own trials and tribulations. He's been moving for years and years. It was house to house to house, location to location on a nightly basis. And now I think he gets to stay in one place for a week and is thrilled about it. But he has no freedom because freedom is the target in those countries. So, and Lars Hedegaard, who actually founded the Danish Free Press Society, was a journalist in Denmark and a huge advocate. That press society wound up giving Kurt Vestergaard an award, and Fleming Rose also. The award goes to those journalists who excel in their work and who refuse to compromise based on fear or the kind of threats that we saw being made to both of those. So the Lars Hedegaard and I, it was Lars Hedegaard, me, Frank Gaffney, who was then head of the Center for Security Policy, and Steve Rose, who worked at the Heritage Foundation, and we were on a panel talking about the threats to free speech after they showed a documentary called Silent Conquest, which I was also in, and so were a lot of other experts on the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the threats to free speech, specifically from the Muslim quarter. And so there was a documentary on it, and then, of course, there was a big controversy with that. I don't know if you want to tell the audience about that.
That's another interesting thing to bring up. So you have another connection here with these cartoons. You misspoke. I think Geert Wilders, we both met, he's a Dutch politician in Holland, not Denmark. I think you've confused him there.
Netherlands, yeah. I apologize.
But he, of course, has across borders in Europe, has had a lot of contact with people like Lars Hedegaard in Denmark, and facing similar issues as you discussed with his, I believe he had a recent conviction for that speech you talked about, how he said he advocated, look, we don't really want more Moroccans in Holland because, as you indicated, they're not really integrated. But now, in this film, Silent Conquest, and I was there for that panel at the Heritage Foundation, if I recall correctly, that was in 2013, at the Heritage Foundation to screen this film, Silent Conquest. It was precisely this disturbing aspect that you had this film about free speech under assault from Sharia threats, jihadist threats, and yet when they showed these Danish cartoons in the film Silent Conquest, they actually blurred them so you couldn't see them, right? So, we don't want to see these offensive images all of a sudden in this film about free speech, which I later wrote about at American Thinker in an article called Blurred Image, about this whole panel and this whole controversy that the director had decided to blur the very images up. What happened there in that film, and was that later corrected?
Well, actually, it was a surprise to all of us on the panel that the images were going to be blurred, because we had seen the documentary and prior to the event, and when we saw it, the images were all there. And my understanding is that from Steve Groves, although I think the producer had a different version of what happened, but he said he was aware that there were two versions, one with blurred images and one that showed the images, and that he assumed that the ones without the images were for example, Muslim audiences or, different audiences where they'd be offended. But in any event, nobody on the panel knew that we were going to get the version that was blurred. I think we all either assumed we were getting the version with the pictures, and some of us, like me, I didn't even know there were two versions. So it was really quite a surprise, and I think some of them were very upset. You know, like Frank Daphne was very upset. It didn't make sense to a lot of the people. It doesn't make sense to me either. I guess I was a little more sympathetic to the producer. I know her. She was afraid, so I can understand that. But it does seem a little bit ironic to have a film and a panel about freedom of speech and then not show the images that the whole panel and discussion was centered around. A similar thing happened with Yale Press University, where a whole book was written about Islamic censorship and censorship of the Muslim prophet Muhammad, and it didn't have a single picture in it. So it's fear.
Fleming Rose talks about that in his book, Tyranny of Silence, the Yale book, that they wouldn't even, you know, they're so afraid, they wouldn't even show the very cartoons that were at issue here in this question of free speech. But Fleming Rose himself talks about how the Yale Post in 2010, they decided against reprinting the cartoons because they had received so many death threats. And so they were afraid that, well, you know, if we republish these cartoons, you know, are we then, going to be blamed for any violence? So there, in that case, later on, the Yellen's Poston under Fleming Rose actually decided, well, no, we better not show these cartoons again. So there, there's a question there that, you know, violence is really working here, is really scaring the people from showing these cartoons again. Well, what do you think about people saying that these cartoons were inappropriate, that they were, say, racist or something? Like, for example, do you agree with the argument some people say that these cartoons are sort of equivalent to, like, Holocaust denial, you know? They were just really bigoted cartoons.
Well, first of all, Islam's not a race, number one. Number two, when there is Holocaust denial, nobody is going around bombing the people who deny it. No one's going around killing people. So, no, I don't agree with it. I saw Fleming Rose, and I believe you were at this event also, Andrew, at the museum years and years ago when he gave a speech. And the person who was the moderator, who worked, ironically, in the First Amendment Center, to be honest with you, I'm not sorry that that place shut down, because they used to have a lot of resources in that First Amendment Center, but the head of the First Amendment Center, who had Fleming Rose there, was asking Fleming Rose, don't you think that it's prudent to censor these cartoons because they are offensive, and we censor other things, like when there's car crashes, we don't show all the blood and the gore because we want to be sensitive, and it's like good manners, and it's offensive to people. And good for Fleming Rose, he wouldn't let any points that this moderator made go by unaddressed. He was clear and unequivocal and said, absolutely not, it is not the same thing. First of all, we do show car crashes, and we do show blood and guts. It's all over the papers and the media. But second of all, the reason that people are censoring this is not because they want to be nice people or sensitive. It's because they were afraid. And in fact, in the case of the Danish cartoons, the illustrators told the author of the children's book it was because they were concerned for their safety that they refused to do the illustration. And one point I want to make about that article in UN Posten, which I think I omitted, was the purpose of those cartoons was to show people what the cartoon, you know, just, they had an article. It was to accompany an article which was prompted by that self-censorship on the children's book. And the question was, should people in the media self-censor to cater to a small minority of violent jihadists who are going to threaten people in response to speech they find offensive? It was an intellectual article that was hoping to inspire a civil discourse and a debate on the issue of media self-censorship. And to make the point, they had the cartoons. Of course, the entire purpose of that article was obscured because the jihadists were too focused on the cartoon. But repeatedly and to this day, Fleming Rose is a staunch and unequivocal advocate for freedom of speech. He's paid a hefty price for it. His publication has paid a hefty price for it. People have died. People have paid with their lives. Dick Bilder has paid with his freedom. And even though Jalon Posen might have decided not to repost those cartoons in 2010, as I'm sure you know, Charlie Hebdo, a French magazine or newspaper, did publish them, and they wound up in the same situation. So they got death threats, and more than threats, there were people killed. There were people killed there, and the Jewish grocery store across the street. And subsequently, the French government, not just the government,
Debbie, you've gone at least for me somewhat weak. Can you hear me?
I don't know what to do about it. I didn't.
Oh,
there
we go.
Hear you.
Fleming Rose came and spoke at the New Zealand.
I can still hear you.
Fleming Rose came and spoke at the museum, as you said. That was, I believe, in 2016 or 2017. I'm trying to remember. We were both there. He had spoken the same day at Cato.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he had spoken the same day at the Cato Institute, which was the publisher of his book, The Tyranny of Silence, and he was making a book tour. And, you know, as you indicated, I'm also not really sad that the museum shut down as well, because the museum was very that whole First Amendment Center and the whole staff there was indeed very left-leaning and always engaging, and particularly with regard to Islam, always engaging in apologetics for Islam and talking about Islamophobia and so forth. And that would indeed be
Islam. If it's the First Amendment Center, they should be advocating for what the spirit of the First Amendment is, which is freedom of speech, and instead they were advocating for censorship. And it's interesting, Andrew, because I can't remember the guy's name who was the head of it there, the moderator, but, Fleming Rose made all those great points, and subsequently I heard that same moderator literally about a week or two later give a speech somewhere else where he went unchallenged and made the exact same points that he initially asked Fleming Rose, as though Fleming had never responded to him, how he didn't address it. And just so you know, for people out there, that museum was funded by taxpayer dollars. So I hardly think our taxpayer dollars should be funding advocates of censorship. So what I was trying to say before about the Charlie Hebdo, if you didn't hear me, I hope your audience still heard me. The sound was fine here. But they, the Charlie Hebdo published those cartoons in 2010, and people were killed in response to that. And in the meantime, the French government also has free speech restrictions in their laws, and they arrest people and put people in jail, even for things like Facebook posts. So,
I think
now would be a good time to mention to the audience that the way that the blasphemy laws work in Islam is totally contrary to the Judeo-Christian values that we have in America, or at least we used to have. I don't know if we still have them. But in their religion, if you blaspheme Islam or Muhammad or Allah and they commit violence against you or kill you, the person who's responsible for it is the person who made the offensive comment or produced the offensive film or who drew the offensive cartoon, instead of the person who's committing the violence. It's called a test of consequences, and it shifts the burden from the violent actor to the person who's making the speech. And that is in complete contradiction not only to American laws, but also to Judeo-Christian principles, which are firmly rooted in the idea of personal responsibility.
Yeah, indeed. That's been discussed before. And that result, of course, as you indicated in the case of the Charlie Hebdo massacre in January 7th, 2015. But in Islam, you're not supposed to challenge Islam, and if you condemn Islam, criticize it, then you're responsible for whatever happens to you. And indeed, truth is defined according to what Islamic doctrine says is true. And so it's not an objective standard of truth or falsehood. It's whatever Islam says is true. And so defamation then in Islam means that anything you say that condemns Islam, it's not a question, again, of truth there, once again, is no defense.
It's not that Islam decides what's true. It's that Islam doesn't care what's true. They don't care if it's true or not. If it's offensive, it's defamation or blasphemy, whether it's true or not. So it's not that they're not necessarily disputing the truth of it. They just don't think you should say it, even if it's true. That's all.
I also think you
brought me on to talk about Kurt Vestergaard and the Islamic aspect of it, but I really think that we would be remiss, Andrew, if we didn't broaden the discussion a little bit in light of what's going on in our society. I mean, in the last year or so, I mean, the censorship and cancel culture has just completely exploded. And I hardly think that the Islamists are the main problem over here anymore. Before it was creeping Sharia, but who cares about the creeping Sharia when you have all this socialist, wokeness, leftist censorship and other aspects of socialism right in your face, literally pushing down the gates of our country. And, a long time ago, for example, I did a speech in Canada on Motion 103, which was an anti-Islamophobia motion passed in the Canadian Parliament. And at that time, a lot of people were blaming Muslims for that motion that passed. But I had to point out to them that while the Muslims wanted that motion, they weren't the ones sitting in Congress who were passing it. It was the leftists, not the Muslims, who were drafting these resolutions and these bills. It was the leftists who were voting on them. It was the leftists who were passing them. It was the leftists who were enabling them. And the Islamists who wanted censorship, whether it's in Canada or Europe or here, can't get it without somebody helping them, because they're not the majority. They aren't the main ones in Congress. They aren't the main ones running the country. They aren't the main ones writing the rules. And it was largely, I shouldn't even say largely, it was entirely the left, not everyone in the left, but of the people who were helping them, it was comprised of entirely of the left. You didn't have Ronald Reagan or, anybody on the right who was helping them do this, because we believe in freedom and freedom of speech. But now, as you can see, that censorship, which the leftists stood by, they either looked the other way, and actually worse, they supported it, enabled it, helped it, justified it, like the moderator from the museum, and it spread. It spread to college campuses, it spread to the media, it spread to arts and entertainment, it spread to technology and Facebook and Twitter, where we see people having their posts taken down. And it's not just on the issue of terrorism or Islamists or there's a whole range of issues. If you have a conservative view, you can't discuss it. You have a different opinion, you can't discuss it. And the issue of censorship in America, which still from a legal point of view is the freest country in the world on the issue of speech, is in really grave danger right now. And I'm quite concerned about it, because freedom of speech is a cornerstone of democracy. It's an enabling right. Without freedom of speech, you're going to lose all the other freedoms. You're going to lose political freedom. If you can't protest other kinds of wrongs because you don't have freedom of speech, you're going to lose your political freedom. You're going to lose your human rights, your civil rights, your religious freedom rights. And the list goes on and on. So freedom of speech is the foundation for everything else that we have, and we're quickly losing it. And kids in school don't even understand the importance. If you the importance of it. If you take a there were surveys done on college campuses, and even among students that consider themselves Republican or conservative, a lot of them believe that we should have hate speech laws because they think wrongly that the whole thing is about we should be nice. You know, we shouldn't offend anyone. You shouldn't say anything nasty. But that's really not the issue. I mean, I'm not sitting here saying, oh, yeah, you should call people names and you should make racist comments. I'm not saying that. But on any policy or political issue, we should be able to have an open and honest, fair debate on the merits of the issue and have a free marketplace of ideas. It should not be like you have to be in lockstep with the mainstream thinking in order to express your views. And that is what the left is trying to do. They're trying to do it in Congress. They're trying to do it in some of the state legislatures where they just, you know, run away if there's a vote because they don't want to have the discussion. And we don't need a First Amendment for the mainstream view. We don't need a First Amendment for everything that sounds sweet and nice and apple pie. We have the First Amendment to flesh out minority viewpoints and give the dissent an opportunity to air their views because, hey, guess what? Sometimes those views are better, and they should be able to see the light of day and have their chance to be heard in the public square and let the best man win. Am I allowed to say that? Am I allowed to say the best man, or do I have to say, you know, person, he, she, whatever? So I, you know, the thing is, in a free marketplace of ideas, when you have that as a value, you take an issue, you flesh out all of the facts, and then you have a discussion. Is it a good idea or a bad idea? Should we not, you know, should we defund the police or should we not defund the police? But once you start labeling things, oh, this is racist, oh, this is Islamophobic, oh, if you want borders, then you're a xenophobe. The purpose of that name-calling, Andrew, as I'm sure you know, is to shut down the debate. And it's often because the other side knows that if you have an intellectual conversation about it, they're going to lose. Their position is going to lose. But the big problem that I think I've really realized in the last year, Andrew, is they don't care about that. They don't care if you point out to them that you're not playing fair and square, that people should be able to discuss it on the merits and see who has better ideas, that we should have a fair and reasonable discussion, and would both sides be willing to lose the debate if that's the case. They don't care. They just want to win. They don't play by the same rules. They do it by force, by power, by might, and not by right. I'm not sure what the solution is to that, but I know we're late in the game. We better take back our schools, and individuals have to play a role and become more active. I don't know what to say. It's very concerning. The Islamists was one section of the society where the censorship was coming from, but now it's rampant. It's rampant. I mean, I cannot go outside my door and say that I'm a conservative. It will be a big problem, a big problem. And if you apply for a job that's not a political job, for example, if you want to apply at a college to be a teacher, even though you're not teaching anything to do with this, you could be teaching math. If they find out you're conservative, it's a big problem. That is not how America was set up.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this plays into this idea that people have discussed before of a red-green alliance, you know, these leftist, socialist, Marxist people aligning with, you know, these Islamist, you know, groups like Council on American and Islamic Relations and so forth. As you mentioned, Canada and elsewhere, you know, anyone trying to push some sort of suppressed speech about Islam, you know, they can't do it on their own. They need the help of this broader leftist coalition. And you see now with big tech, I mean, we had the issue of, like, the suppression of the Hunter Biden laptop story during the 2020 election, which many indicate, there have been surveys that indicate that had more people known about that, Biden could have actually lost the election. I mean, you know, you're talking about, may I say, say that, you know, you talk about man or whatever, you know, we have this now, this whole transphobia idea that you've got to call a person, a man who identifies as a woman, you can't state the biological facts that, hey, look, you know, a man can't become a woman. And Fleming Rose himself wrote about this in this Tyranny of Silence book that he noted in Denmark that these laws against hate speech, they started out, I believe, in 1971. He noted there have been various revisions of the law of the laws in Denmark that have expanded their scope, encompass more speech. Like, for example, he noted the incident of a woman once wrote a letter to the editor in Denmark saying that she considered, a Christian woman saying that she considered homosexuality, you know, sodomy, to be among the most disgusting forms of fornication, and she just barely escaped a conviction under one of these hate speech laws in Denmark. So, yeah, there's just more and more interlinked groups that are coming in are saying, you can't say that, you're going to lose your job, you're going to get silenced, you just can't say that.
Yeah, well, actually, I don't know what the date is, but I think it's important to mention that perhaps some of the European countries had laws starting, but the huge push for the speech restrictions actually was in the U.N., and even though it wasn't a legally binding document, it was actually the UN Declaration of Human Rights actually has prohibitions against group hate speech laws. And they don't apply to America because we opted out of that. We signed what's called the reservation, saying, hey, we'll sign the human rights aspect of this document, but we're just letting you know we believe in free speech and we're not going to adhere to these clauses that ask us to write hate speech laws. Now, though the document isn't binding, it's not forcing countries to do it, but the countries that didn't opt out, which is all of them except for us, actually, were asked to write legislation that comported with those restrictions, and that's what they did. And a similar thing in the European, I'm trying to remember what it's called now, the EU... Boy, I can't remember off the top of my head right now, but there's a European body that also was asking countries, actually, what they were asking countries to do to make it more unified is to move the speech restrictions from having civil penalties. For those of you in the audience, that means you'd be slapped with a fine, for example, and to change it to criminal penalties, which could mean potential jail. So that's Europe.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and Fleming Rose talks about, in particular, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which was drawn up in the 1950s, and there is that clause in there, in its Article 20, Paragraph 2, there's a specific clause on free speech saying that there is indeed an exemption for restricting free speech for issues of hate speech towards racial or religious groups, speech that incites hatred or discrimination. Fleming Rose notes that actually when that paragraph was being drawn up in 1953, that most of the Western democracies actually voted against incorporating that clause in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and people like Eleanor Roosevelt argued, you know, that's simply vague language and, you know, would just lead to all sorts of restrictions, but it is indeed there. And so now you have then that exemption for such hate speech laws. Well, what do you think? Fleming Rose goes into great detail in this issue in The Tyranny of Silence. What do you think about the justification for hate speech laws? Do they make any sense?
What was the justification?
What do you think about the justifications that the arguments that people make for hate speech laws? Do they make any sense?
No, I mean the hate speech laws. Okay, let me put it to you this way. Some people argue that when you have offensive speech, it increases violence, but the statistics don't bear that out. And if you look around the world, the countries that have censorship are the countries that have more violence. You know, it's the Islamic countries where they have blasphemy laws, where there's more violence because the people are violent toward the people who have that speech because they, in their own minds, decided it was a justification, so they're justifying it. But if you have a country like America, which is truly based on a foundation of freedom, then people understand or should understand that true freedom means you look the other way when you have a minor offense. You advocate, and if there's bad speech, you respond to it with more speech. You have to have a free marketplace of ideas. And in truly free countries, especially if we're going to have people from other countries and other cultures and other religions and other languages come into our country, then we have to have true tolerance, which means diversity of opinion and the ability to speak freely. So, you know, here you are, you have the left always talking about diversity. They want you to be able to be black and white and green and purple and, you know, homosexual and bisexual and trisexual and triplesexual, as long as you all have the same opinion. But true diversity means diversity of opinion and diversity of thought. It's not about what you look like. So, no, I don't think that those laws are justified.
Well, yeah, you talk about diversity of views, and going back to these Muhammad cartoons, like this Kurt Vestergaard cartoon with the character of Muhammad with a bomb in his turban. You know, it strikes me, Fleming Rose's book brings up this interesting case in Spain after the March 11th, 2004, the so-called 311 bombings by an Al-Qaeda cell of the Madrid train station. There's a woman, Maria Gomez in Spain, who her husband was among those killed in the attack, and she later began wearing this T-shirt with the Kurt Vestergaard character on it, and indeed tried to wear it to the trial of the terrorists, and the court told her she couldn't wear it because it was, influencing the court or, you know, improper to wear such a political statement like that in the court and impinging upon its neutrality, that the defense lawyers were objecting and the defendants were objecting when they saw this shirt. But, Fleming Rose brings up the issue that, you know, for someone like Maria Gomez, whose husband was killed by Al-Qaeda in this Madrid bombing in 2004, for such people, they really regard that caricature as true, right? I mean, you had a jihadist terrorist in Al-Qaeda acting in the name of Islam and in their understanding of Islamic doctrine that killed people. So how can you tell a person like that that such a caricature is bad?
Yeah, what's your question? I'm not sure. What's your question? I apologize.
Well, doesn't that show how precisely, like, we just can't look at symbols the same way? Like, can we all agree on, like, the Confederate battle flag? Like, someone might say, oh, that's my Southern heritage, and, you know, other people say, no, that's just really racist. I mean, don't we just have to argue about these things in free societies?
Right, you have to argue about these things in a free society. Yeah, I agree.
It brings up another issue recently, under the Hamas rocket fire in Israel. You had Jews in Jerusalem chanting, like, the Islamic faith is garbage and Muhammad is dead and so forth. So there's a similar issue there that, you know, why should Jews in Israel respect this Islamic faith if it is indeed a source of violence against us? I mean, it'd be like demanding of Americans that we respect the Japanese Emperor Hirohito during World War II, who under this state Shintoism ideology was considered divine.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I was trying to send you a message. I'm not sure what your question is.
Well, I guess I was just asking for any sort of comments or thoughts on that. Those are interesting points. You need diversity. Well, I guess it brings up then an issue of all our images and language and our thoughts being manipulated, right? That, you know, you're saying that we can only have one view of one thing. You know, we cannot disagree. So is then our language then and our thoughts being manipulated?
Yeah. So one thing is censorship, which is just the suppression of the speech because they want to suppress the whole idea and the thought. But the other thing that's going on, it went on quite a bit with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, does it in their UN resolutions, but it's also going on in society, which is the manipulation of language and the redefinition of words. So the defamation that we spoke about earlier is one good example of that, where defamation means one thing to us in the American legal system, which is a false statement of fact, but in the Islamic world, defamation means anything that is blasphemous speech, even if it's true. So that's an example, but it's also going on quite a bit, very rampantly now, where we see how language is just being manipulated, or, you know, even what words are. To be honest with you, like, anything that the left doesn't like is labeled a certain way. You know, it's racist, or it's this, or it's that, the name-calling, even though they can't support anything that would really deductively come to a conclusion that those comments were racist. But, you know, you mentioned the trans. I mean, you know, if you have male DNA and you know, put on a dress and a wig and call yourself Susan, now, you know, we have to refer to you as a woman. Otherwise, you know, we're, you know, bad people. But there's just a whole, what's the definition of racist? I mean, that's changed over the last year. You know, racist used to be if you discriminated against somebody on the basis of the color of their skin. But now you have white woke college students telling black police officers that they're racist because they believe in individual responsibility and individual freedom. So the whole language is changing. It's like the 1984 Orwell novel, and it's 1984 now. And people have to be very aware of what's going on, and I think institute some critical thinking skills. Another thing that's been lost over time, not taught in school, they're taught conformity now, not, you know, remember it used to be like, I might not agree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. Whatever happened to that, that is gone. Now you have to comply and conform or you're an immoral bad person. Using what frame of reference for morality? I have no idea, but it's certainly not Judeo-Christian, a Judeo-Christian reference point, that's for sure. So I think we have to use critical thinking skills, especially people who don't have a lot of time. If they're just listening to the mainstream media, unfortunately, you are being misinformed. You are being propagandized to. It's full-on propaganda at this point. And when you hear words like racist, sexist, Islamophobic, xenophobic, take xenophobic. If you look at what's going on in the borders, and we're being flooded in a way that is completely inconsistent with our rule of law, completely inconsistent with our real ideas of humanity, completely inconsistent with the idea of sovereignty, of national sovereignty, and without borders, you have no country, yet, if you want our laws to be enforced on the border, now you're a xenophobe, you know. So I think that people have to try to learn some critical thinking skills and distinguish facts from opinions, characterizations from facts, ask where you're getting your conclusions, and don't just go turn on CNN or MSNBC and say, oh, they said this politician's a racist, therefore it must be a true fact. You know, ask, why do you think that? How are you defining your term? Always make people define their term, because what the term means to them might be not what the term means to you, or even more likely, they might not be able to define the term. They just want to use it for political aims. So I think we're out of time now, Andrew, but I want to thank you very much for inviting me to speak here, and I just want to leave the audience with the conclusion that about the importance of free speech, and it's not just about the First Amendment, because I get a lot of people saying to me, oh, it's okay if Facebook censors everybody because they're a private company, so they have the, you know, it doesn't violate the freedom of speech, or, oh, you know, we can censor people in this quarter or in that public square or wherever it is because, you know, it's not the government. But you know what? I never said I was a First Amendment advocate. I said I'm a free speech advocate, and the spirit of it, I mean, it's a longer conversation, more than we have in an hour, but places like Twitter or Facebook are the public square. In a way, they've taken the role of the government, but it's the concept of freedom of speech that is what's important, that has to serve as the foundation to allow other freedoms to prosper and to flourish. And by the way, I have reason to believe that the government with this administration is largely consulting with Facebook and Twitter anyway. I don't think that the censorship is totally on their own initiative. And I think government is doing it in an indirect, backhanded, and in my opinion, illegal way if they're really doing it, because what the government isn't allowed to do directly, they aren't or shouldn't be allowed to do indirectly. But so America is the only country that has the First Amendment. We used to have a spirit of free speech. We are quickly losing it. We have to fight against it. We have to fight against it with the left in the educational system, with the government, even self-censorship. Self-censorship we have to fight, guidelines for censorship, college guidelines for self-censorship. You know, Clark, school is it called Lewis and Clark? One of the schools that I was reading had in their guidelines, like, you shouldn't say we're going Dutch on a date. You should just say we'll split the bill, because I guess you'll offend all the Dutch people that are with you on the date. I don't know. But that kind of nuttiness isn't just a little crazy. It's actually dangerous, because the loss of freedom doesn't happen overnight. Just because we didn't sit there and take a black pen and cross out the phrase free speech or First Amendment doesn't mean that it's not in peril. First, you have to create a climate where speech restrictions will be accepted, and we are already quickly there, and it goes gradually. Self-censorship, societal censorship, policy guidelines in schools and government agencies, and next are going to be civil fines and then criminal penalties. So we're already slipping down that slippery slope, and I hope people will wake up, not in a woke kind of way, but to be active, go to your school boards. A lot of people are starting to fight the indoctrination of our students in schools now. But, I'm very concerned about the direction this country has taken. This is not the normal Republican-Democrat pendulum. And for those of you who think so, it's because you're only listening to mainstream media. So wake up, become active. If it isn't important to you, by the time you realize it, it's going to be too late. So, that's it.
All right. Well, excellent. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harris, where we like to talk about important events of the day for conservatives and others. And we've been listening here to attorney and free speech advocate Deborah Weiss, who has worked previously with the Congressional Committee on House Oversight and is the author of numerous publications, including the Center for Security Policy Monograph, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Jihad on Free Speech. Emphasize here, free speech is indeed the lifeblood of democracy, and we really have to stand up for it. Well, Deborah, thank you for joining us here on the show.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
All right, well, our listeners out there, tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.